This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. In his work, world-renowned landscape architect W. Gary Smith celebrates the relationship between people and plants. He's designed and implemented major botanical gardens and outdoor installations all over North America and understands the intersection of art and landscape design. Well, now, Gary Smith has been commissioned to do a project that will bring those principles to this region and to Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden. He'll be designing, in fact, he's already designed a medieval garden for children called the Lost Hollow, and he joins us to talk about that garden, designing on a large scale, and more. Welcome to the program, and welcome to Charlotte. Nice to meet you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here. Also with us is Karen Newport, who is Executive Director of Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden out in Belmont. Thank you for joining us as well. I think you've been on this program before, haven't you?
I have, yes.
Welcome back. I mentioned that you've designed gardens all over North America, the Santa Fe Botanical Garden, the Children's Garden at Lady Bird Johnson, the Wildlife Center in Austin, the Brooklyn Botanical Garden in New York, gardens in Alabama and Delaware and Florida, to name just a few places. And all of those places are very, very different in terms of climate, in terms of vegetation, in terms of the number of seasons that they have. Is one area of the country more difficult than the other to do what you do in? I mean, it would seem that Santa Fe is not terribly hospitable.
Well, I don't think they're one area is really no different than the other, as long as I'm talking to experts locally who know about the plants. And that's one of the advantages of working in botanical gardens, is there's always a staff of horticulturists that know about the local stuff. And I find if landscape architects actually listen and don't just come in acting like they're the expert, listen to the locals, you can't lose.
There's a person that you write about in your book that as a young man, you used as kind of a mentor. I've forgotten his name now, but I think it was you who said to him, I can't see what you did here. It looks very natural. And he took that as a compliment. Talk to me about that, and then talk to me about what your style is like.
Well, thank you. There was actually two mentors at that time, and at two opposite ends of the spectrum. And A.E. Bai is the landscape architect you're talking about from Connecticut.
Okay.
And his greatest compliment was when it looked like his hand was not involved. He loved native plants. He loved the native landscape. And he wanted it to look like it was done by nature, even though it was highly orchestrated by him. The other one was a Brazilian landscape architect named Roberto Burley Marx. And he was a friend of all of those painters in the 50s and the 60s that were very abstract. And his goal was to create a garden that looked like an abstract painting, that did not look like nature. And bright colors, bold forms. And so both of those folks were mentors of mine, and it's kind of fun to play around with those different ends of the spectrum.
So how would you describe your own work?
How would I describe my own work?
Your approach?
Well, I would say that there is a level of abstraction, but rather than bring in my own sort of personal vocabulary, my own palette of colors, I do like to look at the local region and talk to the client locally and see what's going on there and try to make abstractions of what the local patterns are.
You also encourage landscape architects to design public spaces that focus on plants and horticulture. And when I read that, I thought, well, what do landscape architects who don't focus on that end up doing?
Well, I don't want to say too many negative things about my colleagues in landscape architecture, but architects do like to complain about each other. A lot of landscape architects are more concerned with the built elements of the landscape, the paving patterns, the furniture, all of the stuff that's not living and growing. A lot of landscape architects come from a variety of disciplines, including architecture. Very few these days come out of horticulture and begin with plants as their primary interest when they're young.
And you do.
Well, I had a horticulture degree from the University of Delaware, and it was all about plants for me in the very beginning.
The space that you're designing at Daniel Stowe is intended to be a children's garden, and I know that you've designed other children's gardens, at least one other children's garden. What goes into designing a garden for children? What's the difference?
Well, you know, people ask me when I've designed a children's garden, they're familiar with things about kids, and they'll say, well, what age group were you really focusing on? And my typical answer is I'm focusing on 35 and up. I think one of the things that I think children's gardens ought to be is appealing to grown-ups. They ought to be appealing to the 8-year-old that's in everybody. And so I think fantasy and play and whimsy and all that stuff is great for kids, but it's also great for us older folks.
I think it's interesting that you said the 8-year-old in all of us, because I read that you like to design gardens for children from a 12-year-old's perspective.
Well, 8, 12, yes, it's around that age group that I tend to place myself in when I'm working on these things.
And how do you do that? Because you're not 12. You're not 8.
Well, I don't know. Talk to my friends and ask them about that. I feel 12 and I feel 8. I don't take myself that seriously as a designer. I like to experiment and play, and I'm open to new things. And I don't know, just looking at the landscape, walking in nature, visiting gardens is always a fresh and interesting experience.
I remember when the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden was first announced and when it first opened, and I think I was out there somewhere around the very, 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 very beginnings of this, when there was really nothing there, Kara. How has it changed in the time since that time, and how does this project, this children's garden, fit into the overall theme, picture, mission of Daniel Stowe?
Well, in the few years since we've opened, we've grown up. As I tell people, I think we've just gone through our teenage years from a plant perspective. Our plants are now becoming adults, becoming mature size. So the landscape looks very different than it did when we first opened. And as many people know who have been there, it's an Italianate main building and a very formal garden. But as we talk about Dan Stowe and his legacy, Dan Stowe was an interesting character, and while he came from the textile industry and a well-known family in the area, he had a whimsical side, and so even in the plant palette that you see in the garden, it's this formal area, but there are pretty wild plant combinations, combining, you know, traditional plants with tropicals, and pretty bold from a plant perspective. So when we selected Gary as the architect, and Gary and I have known each other since our University of Delaware days, so we go way back, but Gary was the clear pick because his sense of place when he creates a design is so clear. He doesn't put the Gary Smith Garden in a garden. He looks at the garden, he looks at the history, looks at the area, the region, like he said, and he picks up on those elements and puts them into the garden. So in this case, we literally are bringing Dan Stowe into the design, and that's where this idea of a deconstructed castle came from.
Let's talk about Daniel Stowe, because although he's a big name in this area, particularly out in Gaston County, there are a lot of newcomers to this area who know nothing about Daniel Stowe. Talk to me about who he was or who he is, and why this garden is associated with Daniel Stowe.
Daniel Stowe is part of the textile industry, R.L. Stowe Mills, and both Far Yarns, both of those textile businesses. But over time, he was really a preservationist. He amassed a lot of land, in fact, 1,200 acres on the banks of Lake Wylie for the purpose of preserving that land. And then as he got older, he realized that he wasn't going to be able to hold on to that land in perpetuity, so he wanted to do something to allow people to access the land. And so his first idea was actually based on the Atlanta Botanical Gardens opening of their conservatory, and he thought it would be great to have a glass house out in Gaston County. And then as he started researching and looking into it, and from his own travels into Europe, he realized that probably a full-scale botanical garden would be more appropriate. So he and the original designer, Jeff Rausch, developed a 50-year master plan for the garden. So we're about a quarter of the way into that, and mm-hmm. a children's garden was in the original master plan. So
I was going to ask you why you chose to have a children's garden. Why was it in the original master plan?
Well, at the time of the original master plan, it was an emerging idea mm-hmm. in gardens, and at that time they were kind of small and very educational. And then since that, they've grown into more integrated elements of a garden. And the reason it was clear to us that that was the next addition to our garden is that we had an increasing number of families with young children coming out to the garden, and we didn't really have a place for them. We were a very formal garden, and there wasn't really an interactive space or a place where they could roam free. It was a little more of a traditional garden experience, a strolling experience. Mm-hmm. So we wanted something a little bit more experiential, something, you know, a safe place to play and a place where people, as Gary said, of all ages could be inspired. So it's a garden area as well.
The official name for this garden is Lost Hollow, the Kimbrell Children's Garden. Talk about the association of the Kimbrell and why the Kimbrell's name is attached to it.
That's a good question. Duke Kimbrell is on our board, and he is also part of the textile industry and was a good friend of Dan Stowe's. So Duke personally loves children and has always supported educational projects. And when we were talking about what's next and trying to think of where we were going, it was a natural fit to go to Duke and talk to him about it, and he immediately put up a $2 million challenge grant. And so we've been fundraising for 2 years now, and we've actually met that challenge. So we're there with the fundraising.
There are a lot. Gardening is America's favorite hobby. We've said this many times on this program, and mostly adults are engaged in gardening, whether it's flower gardening or it's something else. And they're usually complaining about the children running through their flower beds because the kids don't have any appreciation for the work that went into it or the beauty that comes out of it in some cases. So tell me about children and their intersection with a children's garden. What turns them on about this kind of a project?
Well, I think you do have to pay attention to how kids run around. Mm-hmm. They do tend to trample things. And so that's just one of the practicalities of putting together a design for kids is where are they going to run? How are they going to get from one place to the other? And you make the pathways kind of work. As far as the planting is concerned, children love nature. They love plants. And, you know, when we were young, we could go down to the local woods and spend the whole day on a Saturday and play with nature. And then, you know, I had to be home when the streetlights were on. Today, that's not possible, and you need a more sort of enclosed and controlled environment for kids.
It's not possible because we choose for it not to be?
Well, that's a good question. I think some of us live in parts of the city or in places where it maybe not be safe to just let your kid go all day. I'm always amazed at how much time parents spend on the weekend driving their kids around from activity to activity. But they do love plants and they love nature, and what we're doing is providing a lot of opportunities for kids to put their hands in the soil, to turn over rocks and stumps and look for bugs, but also to appreciate things like fragrance and color and the stuff that horticulture brings to us.
But you, I know, and we'll talk about the design of this garden and the pathways that you're creating to take people through the garden, both adults and children, and you just said that you've got to design them so that the kids have a way to get from point A to point B without trampling the plants, but kids don't necessarily want to do that. They don't want to stay on the path. How do you keep them on the path, and what if they don't stay on the path?
Well, that's part of the value, I think, of working in a botanical garden setting, because you do have a staff of people that are familiar with how families get around and are able to untrample something if it gets too trampled.
Right.
Also to change a design if we need to. If a kid makes a pathway through a meadow, then we've learned something about how kids move around that garden, and we do some gardening, which means that things change over time, and the garden adapts to the use that it's getting.
W. Gary Smith is our guest. He's a landscape architect and artist, and the author of a book called From Art to Landscape. He's also the designer of the Lost Hollow Children's Garden, which will be opening shortly at the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden. Karen Newport's the executive director. She's also with us, and we're going to come right back after the break and talk some more about all this. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Robert Moody conducts the orchestra with soprano Sarah Jane McMahon in Berlioz Symphonie Fantastique, February 28th through March 1st in the Belk Theater. Details at 704-972-2000. And Dr. John Powderly at Carolina Bio-Oncology Institute in Huntersville, a cancer therapy and research center specializing in clinical trials for metastatic cancer. CarolinaBioOncology.org. You know, the Founding Fathers set up our system of government to be deliberative and slow, but in our fast-paced modern world, that makes inaction more annoying. But perhaps it's time to take a clue from the slow food movement and relax into slow democracy. Now, we were supposed to have done this show several weeks ago, but we decided to slow things down, and we'll bring Susan Clark in, who's written about slow democracy, tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, 40% of prescription drugs consumed in the U.S. come from India. Now, the FDA is stepping up scrutiny of pharmaceutical firms there after concerns over quality, where our medicine is made, and challenges of ensuring safety.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about landscape architecture and specifically the soon-to-come children's garden at the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden out in Belmont with Kara Newport. She's the executive director there. And Gary Smith is the landscape architect chosen to design this children's garden called the Lost Hollow. I know that you had to pitch, even though Kara said that you were the obvious choice, you had to come out and pitch your idea or at least give your ideas to the board and to the staff. And when you did, you started with a photograph that you include in your book, From Art to Landscape, Unleashing Creativity in Garden Design. And it's a photograph. Actually, when I saw it first, I didn't know what it was, but it's a photograph of gravel that has been raked into a pattern. And then just by happenstance, I guess they're cherry blossoms,
right,
have fallen off, been blown off the trees, and they've fallen into the grooves between, you know, there's a high point and a low point in the gravel, and it's fallen into the low points, the grooves of the gravel. Why did you start with that picture?
Well, because I think it illustrates to me what a garden is all about, which is the union between patterns that are made by humans and then this sort of overlay that happens from natural forces. So those cherry petals blew off the branches of the cherry trees and found their way down into the crevices of that raked gravel, not because the designer told them to.
Mm-hmm.
The particular,
or even knew they would.
Well, correct. And it was the particulars of weather on that particular week, mm-hmm, when the blossoms were ready to leave the trees. It was a very windy time, and they were blown in to the crevices in that raked gravel.
So that's something that really can't necessarily be anticipated or promised and certainly can't be duplicated. It may never happen again. So why include that as a starting point for garden design?
Well, I think one of the main things that we as garden designers do is we put our own creativity into practice, everything we know about climate and weather and plants and how people move through, and mm-hmm, we're aiming for that transformative sort of experience. We're aiming for what I like to call the numinous moment. And my friend Bill Frederick, who's a landscape architect up in Delaware, kind of turned me on to this concept. And I first heard him talk about numinous moment. I looked it up. It's luminous with an N,
mm-hmm,
and it means something that is beyond our own ability to create. Hmm. So we bring our best thoughts to play, and we put the garden all together, but we can't decide when that perfect combination of flowering and wind is going to come along.
So this is one of those serendipitous unintended consequences on the positive side of the scale.
That's right. And those are some of the memorable gardens, or memorable moments in gardens and in nature, mm-hmm, when the sun breaks through the clouds and lights something up. Again, we can't control the clouds.
Right. This children's garden is part of the major project out there. As you say, it's part of the, what, the 50-year plan?
50-year master plan.
What has been in the space where this garden will be?
This area has nothing. The garden's about 110 acres mm-hmm. nestled inside 400 acres, which was what was left of the garden when Dan Stowe planned it and on his passing. And so this area didn't have anything in it. It also didn't have anything planned, oddly. It is next to the site that was originally planned for the children's garden.
So Sarah, it was off to the side, and you weren't even going to do anything.
There was nothing in it, right? There was nothing in it, and the children's garden was planned for kind of up the hill from it. And it's one of the best examples of terrain that we have in the 400 acres, and it's right next to the main canal garden.
So I get the idea, and correct me if I'm wrong, that perhaps when they brought you on board for this, you looked at the space and said, "No, let's use this space."
Well, the space that they had designated for the children's garden was pretty flat. And just across the way was this space that had hills and forests and some real, as you said, some interesting topography and interesting landforms.
Now, did that come to you because you've done this before and you've seen how children use the end product, or did you just look at the space and just see it?
Well, it was this beautiful hollow. And I thought, well, this is a place for a garden. This is much more interesting to explore and to wander through and to create destinations to visit than a big flat piece of lawn.
So when you say there's nothing there, there has been nothing there, what does that mean? There has to be some vegetation growing.
Yeah, right now it was an area that was just outside of the canal garden. So there was some grading done originally. So there was kind of an area that we maintained as a mown area. And then there's, you know, some interesting new and old growth. So there's some older growth trees. So mm-hmm. it's a forested area, which yeah. will be a new addition for us. We do not have in our formal garden area a shade garden, a tree-covered area. And then there was also an area that's been cleared that we did not mow, where you have an example of the successional forest. So some real ecology at work and what we call the new forest. So we kind of have an old forest and a new forest.
What is a successional forest?
A successional forest is what happens. It's a natural cycle. So when you have a clearing, whether it's man-made or natural, you kind of have this succession that comes in. First it's the grasses, and then you start getting this, in our area it's cedars that come in, and then from there you go into sweet gum and beeches, and then you get into oaks and the older growth hardwood trees.
So you come in, you're brought in to design this garden, you choose the area that you want to work in. Where do you begin? I mean, do you walk the space? Do you photograph the space? Do you decide I'm going to plant trees, or I'm going to plant this here, or I'm going to take this tree out, or I'm going to – how does it start? Where does it begin?
Well, I think in this case where we started was with Daniel Stowe. You know, I never had the pleasure of meeting Daniel Stowe, and so I wanted to find out who this person was and what was his spirit. What was the spirit of Dan Stowe that we could bring to children? Mm-hmm. So that's where we began. But then, of course, the next step was looking at the space and thinking about how the sun moves across the sky. Where's the north-facing woodland edge and the south-facing edge? Where's the warm parts going to be and the cool parts going to be? Where are the views? We have this promontory that's a natural mound, and it has a view down into the meadow, and that's surrounded by the forest. So where do we walk around to see what the different perspectives are going to be? And then once we understand the particulars of the site and we have a theme put together, and that came from studying Dan Stowe, where are the destinations throughout this garden that are related to this theme that we've established?
It's like designing Disney World, isn't it?
Well, it's not quite as
lavish
or fake. Sorry, Walt.
But it is going to be a medieval garden. What is a medieval garden?
What is a medieval garden? Yeah, they didn't have the kind of gardens that we're building back in medieval times. But where that theme came from was from Dan Stowe.
Okay.
And he loved travel. And he picked up some really interesting antiques and artifacts and put them into his home, which is right near the site. And what we found very early on was that the home that Dan Stowe had built had to be taken down. It had become deteriorated, but it had all these wonderful architectural antiques in it, a giant English Tudor fireplace, an aviary that was 8 feet diameter and 12 feet tall, all kinds of interesting bits and pieces of old world Europe. And from studying those artifacts and saying, well, let's move them and put them in the garden, that's how the medieval theme sort of came to be.
Because those artifacts look...
It felt like old Europe.
And you've described this, and you've already said this once, as a deconstructed castle. Because that's what's happened here, isn't it? I mean, we've taken the house apart.
That's right. We've taken the house apart, and we don't have a castle. We have bits and pieces of a castle that you can discover here and there. And part of the purpose of a children's garden is to inspire imagination in children. So if we build a castle, well, then that's kind of the story. You have a castle. But if we take bits and pieces of a castle and spread it around, then you think, how'd this come to be? What are these pieces? What giant came along and moved all these things around? You want the kids to make up their own stories and to inspire their own imaginations.
Hmm. When you go to Disney World and you see Sleeping Beauty's castle, it is fully realized. There it is. And what you're saying is that if you put bits and pieces of it scattered around a woodland landscape, the kids begin to fill in the blanks themselves.
That's right. At the garden that we designed at Winterthur, the museum up in Delaware, Enchanted Woods, a fairy garden, mm-hmm. We didn't have any particular fairies that lived there. And we created a fairyland that has different features and different destinations that kids can interpret in different ways. There's a giant bird nest. It's 12 feet diameter bird nest that you can actually go into. Mm-hmm. And there was a kid visiting the garden who decided it was a spaceship. And that's what we're trying to do, is we're not giving one story for each of these elements, but giving the opportunity for children to make up stories.
You've also said, even though you just alluded to that other children's garden, that there is nothing like this anywhere in the country. And in fact, Daniel Stowe is asserting, the gardens are asserting, that this will be a memorable experience found, and I'm quoting here, nowhere else on Earth.
We think so. We really think so. I mean, there isn't any place I know of anywhere else outdoors where you can walk into a 5.5-foot fireplace. That just doesn't happen.
And discover what's inside that fireplace is actually a blue-ceilinged cave with little star medallions and a disco ball in the center of it, just like Dan Stowe's party room in his old house.
He had a disco ball?
Of course. He gave some of the best parties in the neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's unique to our garden, and it's unique to our story, and it's unique to the Charlotte region. You couldn't do this in other places because you couldn't have these sorts of things outdoors. So it's really very special.
Well, according to the – I'm going to quote again here from the press materials. This is more than just a garden. It challenges conventional approaches to design with 14 destinations within the garden. And given that I know nothing about conventional approaches to garden design, I want you to explain how this goes off the beaten path.
I think it goes off the beaten path because of the talent of all the different people that are involved in the process. Kara and her staff, members of the board, the community really got involved. And that's one of the things I try to do, is kind of harvest, you know, what's the native creativity in the place. And it's one of the things that makes it really unique. And then I try to bring in some ideas as well. This aviary, for example, Kara said, well, we have this aviary, let's move it to the garden. And it's this circular thing the giant birds used to live in. And I thought,
cage.
Well, it is a big cage. And the way to have it in a children's garden is to put it on a giant Lazy Susan and have it rotate. So you got to, like, make it – that's where you're thinking like a 12-year-old. You got to think, it's not just a birdcage. That's too boring. Let's make it a birdcage that spins around.
Huh.
And my other favorite part of that one in particular is that the kids can all get inside of it while other kids turn it. So the kids are all inside the cage, and then outside the landscape design, the garden design, is of plants that birds love. So the birds are going to be on the outside of the aviary, and the children are going to be on the inside of it.
Exactly.
Just occurs to me, how fast can this thing spin? You'll be having a lot of kids.
It's going pretty slow. Yeah. Don't worry. We've engineered it very carefully.
Now, listeners can go to wfae.org/charlottetalks to see a gallery of pictures from and designs of what we're talking about, the Lost Hollow Garden at the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden. But take us through the garden briefly. It begins, you enter at a place that you've called the Commons, which features artifacts from Daniel Stowe's house.
Yeah, there's a circle of English chimney pots.
And chimney pots are what?
Well, they're these wonderful tall cylinders of sculpted terracotta that were at the top of a chimney up on the roof. And we'd take the smoke up and, you know, above the roof.
So think Mary Poppins, the stuff on the roofs to where the chimney sweeps are.
We would have Dick Van Dyke dancing around these things.
and they're in there. And why did you decide to do that?
Well, because they felt like columns. And we had, what, 7 or 8 of them. And I thought, well, a circle of columns with a big bowl of flowers and plants on top of them would be a really nice entrance feature. And then, of course, in the center of this circular space is the giant all-seeing eye embedded in the pavement.
Now, if you look at the back of the dollar bill, you'll see it's the same idea. Why the all-seeing eye? It's to protect people, right?
And that's right. And it is on the back of the dollar bill, and it's been in a lot of places through hundreds of years of history. We've updated it a little bit. The graphic with the radiating sort of lines coming around it is more like the early 90s painter Keith Haring, who did a lot of graffiti-style painting. I always like to work in a little homage to Keith.
Okay. You move on from there, the Commons, to a place called Moon Keep. It's an observation tower. And what does that allow you to do?
The Moon Keep is perched on that promontory that I mentioned earlier. And from there, you get a view throughout the whole garden. It's the most castle-like, I think, of all the features that we've developed. One of the things that I love about it is that it has flying buttresses. I've never got to design a flying buttress before, and it's very medievally in its sort of architecture. It's great.
What, are they supporting the platform, the flying buttresses?
They appear to support the platform, and that's some of the fake part that I mentioned earlier that Walt Disney was so good at. Mm-hmm. It's really about creating fantasy.
Although they are going to be constructed as real flying buttresses, self-supporting. They're not a form.
They're actually stone archways that are held up by gravity.
Mm-hmm. And this fireplace cave that you talked about a few minutes ago, it's actually the fireplace from his house, the, I don't know what you call, the facing of the
fireplace surround.
You've used that, but you've augmented that with some other objects. And I'm told that the stonemasons had you lay this out on the ground before they put it up so they could see what you wanted.
Well, I think that's a way to really make it happen, is to work in collaboration with all the artisans that are making this. And sure, the stonemasons say, well, look, you just lay it down on the ground the way you want it to be, and we'll just pick it up and put it on the wall.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't. They changed some things.
Well, it's a collaboration. There is a good amount of give and take, and I think that's what leads to success. They've been doing this their whole life. I'm not a stonemason.
Right.
They've got great ideas, and it's fun to incorporate them into the design.
And you're also building an amphitheater, which will have a floating stage.
That's right. The stage floats out over the pond that's going to be there. And while we have lots of water features at the garden, this is our first pond that's part of the public space. And so there's a very natural water feature, but this, you know, very formal stage will jut out over it. And then it's a covered space so that it's very practical from a use perspective. And that's an interesting kind of, I would call it an underlay, not an overlay, is that all these spaces have multiple uses. They have this whimsical, fantasy, inspirational design, but they're very practical from a use perspective.
How do you see the space being used?
It's going to be used by our daily visitors for sure, especially families with children. But I also see a bride getting married on that stage over the pond and her guests all up in the amphitheater. And I could see it as a cocktail party location. I think that it has endless uses for the garden.
Mm. And all the things that we've been talking about these structures that you're building or creating, these using pieces of Daniel Stowe's house and other things as well, we have not talked about plants at all.
There is a rich palette of plants going in here, both native plants and non-native plants. And the plants are used to create areas of interest, different sort of focal points of this and that, seasonal color in the fall or in the spring. But they're also used to integrate the various features. We have drifts of cedars moving across the whole landscape through one feature to the next, and they create unity.
I'm going to talk some more about that, but we have to take a break, and I don't want to get in the middle of something we can't stop. So we'll pick that up on the other side with Gary Smith, landscape architect and artist and designer of the Lost Hollow at Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Lisa Adams Photography, creating visuals and enhancing brands for more than 20 years, specializing in food and product photography. Portfolios online at lisaadamsphotography.com. And Diamonds Direct South Park, offering certified diamonds direct from their own diamond cutters in Tel Aviv. And engagement rings from international designers, including Takori, Jeff Cooper, and Simon G. Diamonds-direct.com. 40% of prescription drugs consumed in this country come from India. And now the FDA is stepping up scrutiny of pharmaceutical firms there after concerns over quality. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about where our medicine is made and challenges of ensuring its safety coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talk is a great place to start. And we'll be back in just 32 seconds.
The Charlotte region is experiencing a critical blood shortage. The Community Blood Center of the Carolinas lost 700 units as a result of the recent snowstorm. And on Tuesday, February 25th, the CBCC bus will be parked at our studios in University City from 10 to noon. To schedule an appointment, go to WFAE.org and click on the events button at the top of the page.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about landscape gardening, specifically about the Lost Hollow, which will open later this year in at the Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden with its designer, Gary Smith, landscape architect and an artist and author of From Art to Landscape, and Kara Newport is the executive director out there. We were talking about some of the plants that might be going into this garden, which we've spent a lot of time talking about the artifacts and other structural elements that will go into designing this and making this a kind of a magical place for kids. What about the plants?
Well, I was talking about how they are used to sort of knit one place into the next. And we're also using the plants, this drift of cedars moving across the landscape, to create a feeling of old age, that the birds have dropped the seeds and these cedars have grown up over the years and the ruins of these little bits and pieces of the castle are becoming enveloped by nature.
Now, when did you break ground on this?
Kara, we broke ground in December.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So December, and it's opening
October,
so that's 11 months, or give or take a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make something that didn't exist last October look ancient and medieval next October?
Well, the various artisans, the stonemasons and so on, love this because they've never had to build something that looks 300 years old. They have to build things that are fresh and clean and perfect, and they really get into it. So a lot of it depends on who's involved in the process, and they love building a ruin. We also use the plants, as I said, to create that veneer of old age.
Now, I promise listeners that one of the things that we talk about is how to take some of these ideas that you're using on a very grand scale and that you do in your professional work and scaling them down to use in your garden at home or wherever you may be planting some things. And I know a lot of the techniques that you are using to build this garden can be found in your book, which once again is called From Art to Landscape, Unleashing Creativity in Garden Design. And you say that cultivating a garden also involves cultivating an artist's eye. Is this a new concept?
Well, it's a fairly old concept, but it's not a very common concept these days. A lot of garden design is all about recreating images that you've seen in books and magazines. It's not really about thinking from within and doing something special that's particular to your own personality and your own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
So this idea of generating a theme and working from what's local is something that applies at any scale. You can do it in your small garden at home. You can do it in a garden the scale of what we're doing at Dan Stowe.
But now you are an artist. You're a visual artist as well as a landscape architect, and some of your work is stunning. All of your work is stunning.
Well, thank you.
Some of it's going in the thousands, and if people, not all of it looks this way, but if people are familiar with Wolf Kahn, it's reminiscent of that in your use of color, because he will see a landscape and he will see purples and oranges that are outrageous and make use of those colors on the trunks of trees, for instance. You've done the same thing in your work. So does your life as an artist inform your work as a landscape designer and vice versa?
It does, and I think that's one of the things that makes landscape design so much fun for me, is that it is related to the artwork, which is all about immersing yourself in the visuals that are around you. I mean, you mentioned Wolf Kahn, mm-hmm. and that he actually sees those colors in the landscape.
So do you?
I do. You know, look in the shadow of something, and it's not black. If you look really, really carefully, you'll see that it's deep blue or there's a warm red. And if you emphasize that, exaggerate that color, then you end up with a palette that Wolf Kahn used.
And can you do that, or do you strive to do that in your work as a landscape architect? Emphasize the color, for instance, or make it out of scale.
You can do that, and you can use plants to do that, mm-hmm. Big beds of bright annuals, for mm-hmm. example. You can also use some of the built elements. I'm working on some broken tile mosaics at the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Center down in Austin right now.
Right.
It's a very rich palette of colors.
In your book, you write about that. You write that landscape architects are taught to minimize the ego and use rational analysis of a site's ecological factors combined with how the space will be used, whereas artists are encouraged to use ego as a positive force. So how do you bring these two philosophies together, because they're diametrically opposed to each other?
Well, you're right, and it took me a while to learn that the ego can actually be a healthy thing. Ego doesn't just mean dominating what's around you and doing what you want. The ego is what's within you, what's your sort of personal being inside. And once you get a handle on that, and you don't want to smear it all over the world, you want to just use that to bring creativity and to bring a sense of uniqueness to the particular place where you're working, your ego becomes an important tool, mm-hmm. not a dominating force.
So if you were to go out and see, when this opens in October, your work at Daniel Stowe or some of your work elsewhere in the country or any other big, grand, well-designed garden, and you love it, and you are a gardener, how could you bring that down to size for your own small backyard garden, unless you own this big estate? How would you do it?
Well, if the purpose of this garden is to inspire imagination, then hopefully what happens is you carry that imagination home with you and you translate these ideas to a smaller scale. You can look at color combinations that might be covering a quarter of an acre, but that color combination can work in your small garden at home as well.
In pots, maybe?
In pots on your terrace in the middle of the city, of course.
Right. You emphasize tapping into one's inner well of creativity to begin designing a garden as an artist might design one. And a lot of people might read that in that book or hear this conversation and just write themselves out of that immediately because they don't think of themselves as being creative. Are they wrong? Does everybody have a creative bone somewhere?
They are terribly wrong, and everybody has more than one creative bone somewhere. I do a lot of workshops with folks who actually don't consider themselves artists. And everyone finds out that there actually is an artist within, and everybody is capable of creating. And if you begin that process not by trying to be Picasso or trying to emulate a famous artist or sculptor that you've seen somewhere, and are really just getting a sense of who you are and what your interests are and working with the materials that are in front of you, you can create what's a work of art. It might not sell in a gallery, but it's going to be a work of art that's satisfying to you.
And that's what's important?
I think so. I mean, particularly working in your own garden. Who are you going to try and please? It's a place where you live. It's a place where you have a cup of coffee in the morning and read the newspaper.
How did this start for you? Because you've been doing this as a professional for a long time, and obviously you're also an artist. Which came first, drawing and painting or landscape gardening?
Well, they both came around the same time. I mean, when I was in old junior high school, we had a greenhouse club, and we would grow chrysanthemums in the fall and poinsettias for Christmas. And the other refuge for me was the art room, and I just loved painting and drawing and all of that stuff. Well, when I went to college at the University of Delaware, I had to choose what to major in, and I thought horticulture would be more practical. Art might be hard to make a living. Mm-hmm. And in my sophomore year of college, I discovered a course called landscape design and found that it's the perfect union of both of those things.
But you'd already been involved in plants. I read that your aunt gave you a book written probably in the 30s about what?
There was a book called Growing African Violets Under Lights in Your Home, which is
concept.
Just hardly an ecological idea. But I did have about 300 African violets growing under fluorescent lights in my bedroom when I was about 10 years old.
Wow. So you've been involved in this your whole life. So this comes as second nature to you. Even maybe it didn't at first, but it's become second nature to you.
I guess that's true. I love being surrounded by plants. I love the magic that I remember one day in the bedroom, looking around and seeing all these African violets everywhere. And you know, African violets, their little flowers are like little faces, mm-hmm. and they were all staring at me at the same time. It was kind of scary, but that intensity of emotion is what you aim for in a garden.
You weren't also growing peyote, were you?
You know what? I never did in Newark, Delaware. We never did any of that kind of stuff. There was magic, but we didn't have to bring it in artificially.
Now, in your book, you talk about shapes, from basic shapes like squares and circles and triangles to serpentine shapes and spirals. These are the shapes that artists use. I know that some artists learn to draw by using circles and things like that. Are these the things you should consider when you are designing your garden at home?
Yes, absolutely. And there, you know, the great thing, I've been studying shapes and patterns for about 20 years now and collecting images, and I found out there's only about 7 or 8 patterns. You've mentioned a good number of them. It's always fascinating to me. How many colors are in the color wheel? Not very many.
Mm-hmm.
How many notes are in an octave? Well, there's 8. It always fascinates me that such complex music can be created from 8 different notes on the scale.
So how do they work in a garden? Are they already there and you just bring them out, or do you create them, or a combination of both?
It's some of each. I think you look in the garden and you see what kind of patterns are in the landscape, and you see what kind of patterns are existing. Those birds dropping seeds and causing the cedars to grow in the landscape, there's a particular pattern there that has to do with just the technology of how a bird processes a seed and how it's ejected from its little body and how it hits the ground.
Really?
And you study that pattern and then abstract it and emphasize it, and you can use it in the garden.
It's one of the shapes in the book is I think it's called the blob. It's just the blob. It's
I don't remember
shape.
The blob.
Maybe
you want to look that up in the book?
Maybe I was on a website yesterday. Maybe I was doing peyote. Who knows?
Maybe
it was your creative side coming out.
But the pattern that I'm talking about with the birds is called the naturalistic drift, where you have a cluster of things up close and they get farther and farther apart as they move away from you.
Okay. You love the serpentine theme in gardens, I read. What is it about that shape, or about snakes? Because that's what it is.
Well, it comes from the serpent.
That's right. That catches your eye.
It's a very ancient form, and of course you can see it in petroglyphs in the rocks that are hundreds of thousands of years old. It is the serpent. It's the way a river moves through the landscape back and forth in a serpentine pattern. In painting and in art and in architecture, the serpentine line in the landscape is something that your eye will follow along, and it's a way that you can draw your eye to a particular focal point by giving it this curving serpentine line to move with.
I think in the book there's a photograph of a field with pretty high grass and some trees that you have cut a kind of a wavy, squiggly, serpentine pattern through the grass. That is your work, right? You did it for a friend?
That is right. Well, actually, it was a client. I was working on an estate in central Virginia. And it was a pasture, and we let the grass grow. Now, here's something you can do in your backyard. Not a problem. Let the turf grow up a little bit. Take the lawnmower. Use the lawnmower like a paintbrush and just mow these long, beautiful, curving lines. You're creating a painting in your own lawn.
You even in one of these photographs, you laid down straw. You went through with the lawnmower to cut the grooves in the lawn, essentially, and then you laid down straw so that became the color.
That's right. So we took the grooves that were mowed into the lawn and filled it in with fresh straw. So you had this bright, pale, yellow tan shown against the dark green.
Mm-hmm.
It's this calligraphy.
Does that really only work in a great big space like an open field? Would that work in a backyard?
I think it can work in a field the size of your dining room table. You're not going to be using a lawnmower to cut it. You can use a little hand shears, but why not think of that as a palette and find ways of drawing these shapes on it?
Michael in Charlotte wants to know why Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden is using more annuals than perennials these days in the garden. He believes perennials to be far superior to the annuals and wants to know what kinds of plants they're using in the children's garden.
That's a great question. I think we use a pretty strong combination of annuals and perennials. Perennials are absolutely, without a doubt, great to use in the garden because they provide perennial interest, and not just in the flowers, but often in the seeds or the, even the foliage. So perennials are great to use, but annuals are important as well, and often they give you that pop of color that you really want at a certain time. So there, we have lots of different audiences at the garden, and they have different interests. But the great thing about the children's garden, Lost Hollow is bringing in specifically a shade area, and it will allow us to do more spring perennials. So that's pretty exciting to us. We're actually right now a very strong summer garden, summer, late summer garden from a perennial perspective. And that's partly because we're full sun. So this gives us the shade, will give us a whole new palette of plants that we can integrate into the garden.
You know, also, excuse me, I'll say about the plant palette. You know, we've spent a lot of time working with your staff and putting together a palette of hundreds of different species of plants, not one of them an annual.
And you say it's not so much, these gardens are not so much about the list of plants that you've decided to grow. It's about the way the plant or the plants relate to each other.
That's right, and that's a challenge in growing in botanical gardens in general, because they are plant collections, and so you want to have as much diversity of plants as you can, because there's that educational function to teach people what kind of plants to grow at home. Mm-hmm. But the plants are also used to provide structure, to create walls and vistas, direct your eye through the landscape, and also using them repeatedly, so the same shape, the same color is used over and over again to give the whole garden a sense of unity.
And in this case, we have an existing palette, because we are keeping some of the mature trees and some of the new growth trees in place. So we're working with the existing landscape as well.
Well, I also love that Kara has allowed me to drive around the entire Danstow garden and point out things that I mature trees that I want transplanted to Lost Hollow.
Relocating some mature trees. Yes, yes.
One
of them, in fact, is from Danstow's estate that that we were able to relocate a giant Japanese maple that's a weeping Japanese maple. And then we had some other mature Japanese maples that are in our outer area that were planted some time ago. And so we're relocating some plants so we have some maturity in the design. It's not all new plants.
One of the improvements Kara's made to the garden over the years is, as the garden's grown up and things have gotten very dense, is to thin things out and open things up and move them around. So we do have these plants that have been in the garden for years.
Which is the great thing about gardening, is that gardening is about continuing to touch and work with your plants.
The Lost Hollow is the children's garden that will open in October, all things going as planned.
It will open in October.
At Daniel Stowe Botanical Garden, Kara Newport is the executive director there, and Gary Smith is the landscape architect who designed and who is implementing the plan out there for that. And you can read more about his work and about his philosophy about all this in his book, From Art to Landscape, Unleashing Creativity in Garden Design. Thanks for the hour.